Moviegoers got a whole passel of monster movies to view in the 1950s. Some, like The Amazing Colossal Man, reflected our concerns about nuclear weapons and what they could do to us. Others were a bit more complicated. Biology, modern science, and of course, A Woman in Distress, all came together in the classic The Creature from the Black Lagoon. It was a rare movie for its time in a few ways, not least of which is that the creature was designed by a woman. The story of Millicent Patrick is told by Mallory O'Meara in the book The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Mallory O'Meara is a film producer, screenwriter, and author. She tells us she seeks creative projects filled with horror and monsters. Mallory counts among her jobs co-hosting a weekly podcast on literature called Reading Glasses. So a fellow radio host. Mallory, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So the monsters drew you in, but Millicent certainly kept your attention, it appears. How did you first become aware of her?
So when I was 17 years old, no one else in my family really loved horror movies, so I had to give myself an education on the classics of the genre. So I was going through all the classic Universal monster movies, you know, Dracula, Wolfman, Invisible Man, and I watched Creature from the Black Lagoon. That was the last one, and I completely fell in love with him. And after I watched the movie, I did what all nerds like to do, and I went online, and I needed to know how the movie was made, how the suit was made, and I looked and found a photo of a woman working on the monster suit, and it said Millicent Patrick, illustrator and designer. And it was the very, very first time I had ever seen a woman working on a monster movie. It was like being struck by lightning. I had never been able to picture myself in that world before.
Did that help confirm what you ended up doing for a career?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I would have become a filmmaker without Millicent Patrick.
Oh, and unfortunately, Millicent has been gone for about 20 years now, so you couldn't thank her yourself, but you're certainly giving a thank you with the book. There's a note in the front of the book about Millicent's name. It sounds like she used a couple different variations.
Seven of them over the course of her life.
Wow. And how much harder did that make it for you to be able to find information about her?
It really made researching her a nightmare. By the end of the project, when I would go to archives or registries, it was like I had to pull out this big scroll of all the names and different combinations of them that she could have been listed under.
So not just that, but I get the sense that she set some other obstacles for you or anyone else trying to follow her story.
Yeah, she was a person who liked to create a persona for herself. So some of the things that she said about her, she was sort of like John Wayne, you know, she crafted a persona for herself to navigate Hollywood with. But unfortunately, even though it helped her navigate Hollywood, it did not help me navigate the research to try to find what happened to her.
All right, so we have some of the basics here. Born in 1915 as Mildred Elizabeth Fulvia Rossi, perhaps best known as Millicent Patrick. We mentioned there are seven different name versions here. But getting into her story itself, by the second paragraph, we're angry. You describe her victory lap for Creature from the Black Lagoon, and it ultimately ended in defeat. What happened?
So while she was out promoting Creature from the Black Lagoon, which Universal sent her on because they were trying to figure out how to promote this new monster movie, and they said, you know, we have this beautiful woman who created him, who designed him. Why don't we send her out on a press tour? She'll be the beauty who created the beast. But the problem was her boss at the Universal Monster Shop was a man named Bud Westmore, and he didn't want people to know that he didn't do the design work. He didn't want people to know that she did it. So when they said that the publicity team said that they were going to send her out, he said, no, no, no. I don't want people to know that I didn't do this. So they had to rebrand the entire tour as the beauty who lived with the beast, sort of shunting her into this maternal role. And she did. She went out on tour. She said that she wouldn't tell people that she designed it. She said she would lie and say that Bud Westmore designed it. But he was still so, so jealous of all. She was on the TV. She was on the radio. She was in magazines and newspapers. And he wanted all that attention for himself. So while she was out on tour, he fired her. And when she came home, she had no job at Universal, and she never worked behind the scenes on films ever again.
Wow. What an amazing jerk.
Yeah.
So I noticed she's in the credits at IMDb, but nowhere on the actual film can you find the name of Millicent Patrick?
That's correct. And so this was a period of time, you know, nowadays we have this 10-minute end crawl at the end of the movie and you see everybody who worked on it. But back in the 1950s, guys like Bud Westmore could get away with this behavior because only the heads of all the heads of the production departments got credit for things. So, you know, Millicent was left out. Chris Mueller, the man who sculpted it, was left out. But the only person who was getting credit was Bud Westmore.
Yikes. Okay. Did you find out what the fate of Bud Westmore was by any chance?
I did. He did pass away in the 70s. And finally, what ended up happening was his bad behavior caught up with him. And when things started changing at Universal, he had such a terrible reputation for someone, because it wasn't just Millicent that he did it to, that when his head came up on the chopping block, they let him go, and he did not survive much longer.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that his life ended a little sooner than he might have planned. Did the telling of Millicent Patrick's story become a much bigger project than you originally planned, Mallory?
Oh, absolutely. I think just if she had only designed Creature from the Black Lagoon, that would have made her worthy of a book for me. But while I was researching her and finding out more of these names that she worked under, I also found out that she grew up at Hearst Castle, which was the summer home of William Randolph Hearst. I found out she was one of the first female animators at Disney. She had a career in modeling and acting, and it was just the tip of the iceberg, really.
Yeah, and there's a lot to talk about, obviously, as we go through the hour. So it sounds like for you and any other woman working in the movie business, there's certainly a kindred spirit in Millicent Patrick.
Oh, absolutely. She really was an incredible woman. She was a Renaissance woman. I think so many of us now, when you work in the arts, you know, you have to wear so many hats to pay the bills, and you have to do all kinds of things. And Millicent was doing that back in the 1950s. She really worked in so many different areas and put up with a lot of things, and she really blazed a trail.
Let me ask, I know we talked about the details that you had to go through and the work to get this, but I mean, ultimately, was it fun? I mean, now you look back at the project?
Oh, absolutely. I had a blast, and I'm on book tour right now, and I cannot wait to get back to it and work on a new book, because you get to read for a living. It's amazing. I love doing research. I love going to the library. I love finding out new things, so I had an absolute blast with it.
I guess I get to read for a living, too. It is fun. I have to admit that. I really enjoy what I do as well. We'll come back and talk more with Mallory O'Meara. She's the author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, or Mildred Rossi, or any one of seven other variations. We'll come back to the names and come back to Mallory O'Meara talking about somebody who is really impressive. We'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Mallory O'Meara, who's a film producer, screenwriter, and author with a real emphasis on horror movies. She's been loving horror movies most of her life and now gets a chance to make them. She's written a book about somebody who created a horror movie character. The book is called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, who designed the Gill Man, the creature from the Black Lagoon. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And we have a bit of a trailer from The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
What was it? Science didn't know, but dedicated scientists were willing to risk their lives to find out.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. This one was a failure. It hasn't changed in millions of years. But here we have a clue to an answer.
Starring Richard Carlson, grimly adventuring underwater in the depths of the mighty Amazon. Lovely Julia Adams, her beauty allure even to the man-beast from the dawn of time.
Well, so Julia didn't have to do much more than look good, I guess, but not unusual for a movie from the mid-50s. But here again, we're not talking about the person in front of the camera. We're talking about somebody behind it. And again, how unusual was it? Have you found any other woman who, up to that point in history, had designed a major movie monster, Mallory?
No, that's really what's incredible about Millicent Patrick, and I'm honestly surprised Universal hasn't touted her more, because she was the first woman to ever get hired for this sort of work in a makeup shop. She's the only woman, even today, who's ever designed a classic movie monster.
Oh, well, and then you broaden out the focus in the book to how unusual still is it that a woman is in charge of a movie in any capacity?
It's still incredibly unusual. We just went through another Oscar season where no woman was nominated for Best Director. It's crazy.
Wow. So, I mean, and so what are the numbers like? I mean, you have some statistics in the book that indicate just how great the paucity of women as directors or producers.
Oh, it's really sad, and that's what's incredible to me. And when I started writing this book, you know, it's so easy to dismiss what happened to Millicent Patrick as, oh, that's how it was in the 1950s. But things haven't really changed that much. We still have a very small percentage of women that are directors of all types of movies, but not just directors. There's so many other jobs on a film crew, you know, editors, cinematographers, production designers, and the percentages are all so, so low. They're all less than 20.
You describe some incidents in the book that happened to you. So, I mean, the whole idea, the whole Me Too movement, I assume some of these things happened before that came to the fore. But I mean, people have just said some really awful things to you or assumed some things about you because you were a woman making movies yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what was interesting is I wrote this book. I started working on it way before Me Too had happened, and not a lot of people were interested in it. And then all of a sudden we sold the book, and then Me Too happened, and people got a lot more open to hearing these kinds of stories. But I wanted to include some of my own experiences in the story of Millicent, because like I said, it's easy to dismiss what happened to her and say, oh, it was back in 1954. That's how things were back then. But it's truly not. You know, these things still happen to women right now, every day. So the easiest and fastest way I knew to illustrate that was to say, here's a story that happened to me 6 months ago.
And so what, I mean, has your, you mentioned that you were so shocked that you couldn't say anything in some of these occasions, but has your response to the garbage that people can do to you changed over time?
Absolutely. When I first started working in the film industry, I think there's a sense that women think that, oh, you know, I'm just not going to say anything. That's just how things are. But it doesn't have to be that way. And now I absolutely say something when someone, you know, sexually harasses me or says something inappropriate. Because, you know, years and years ago when I started working as a film producer, I didn't realize that I could. And now I know that I can, and it makes me feel a lot more strong. It makes me feel a lot more confident. It makes me feel like I can, you know, deal with these things a lot more.
Since the cresting of the Me Too moment, do you find people being more careful and more respectful?
You know, not as much as you'd think. That's the funny part. I think there's a lot of conversation going on, which I think is amazing, but I haven't seen as much of a reflection in how many women are hired. You know, I still have had really, you know, incredible things said to me that I'm still stunned by, but it is getting better. It's a big ship's turn slowly moment, or I think in a few years we'll be a little bit closer to where we want to be.
Mallory Amira, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. You did a little artwork in return for Millicent Patrick. Tell us about your tattoo of her.
I did get an amazing tattoo of her, and that's what sort of started off the whole project. Is when ever since I was a teenager, she's been my hero. And when I started working in the film industry in my early 20s, she became sort of a talisman to me to remind me that, you know, I belong in this industry. I belong making monster movies. You know, Millicent Patrick did it back in the 1950s, so I can do it now. And I got this tattoo of her on my left forearm. And after I got it, I was at a party one night talking to a literary agent that I knew. And he said, oh, tell me about this woman. And up until that point, no one knew anything about Millicent Patrick besides that she had designed the creature. And I said, you know, she designed creature. No one knows if she's still alive. No one knows where she is or what happened to her or where she came from. And he said, you should write that book.
Oh, so this really did lead to the project then.
It did. It did. And I laughed. And he said, no, you really should write this. And it was a why not me moment, because I thought, you know what? I personally want to know so badly what happened to her. I'm going to give it a try.
So we talked about the difficulty of discovering information about Mildred. And I have to ask if that's true even in the Internet age. I mean, obviously, the ability to look for things online has increased many fold over the years. So as much as you talk about respecting and admiring Millicent as a talisman for you from your teen years on, I mean, did you just know that much about her until you started the project? Or?
Absolutely not. I knew almost nothing when I first started working on this project. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. In this age of Google right now, we feel like we have access to so much information, but Millicent lived in an age before all of that. So I really had to go and look at physical things. I had to go into archives and libraries and do a lot of traveling. There wasn't a lot of internet research that I could do.
So, for example, how long did it take you just to find out Millicent's birth name and the basic info about her?
Oh, it took me a year just to get enough information to put together a proposal for the book, let alone even start writing it. It really was a struggle. And I put some of those stories in the book because I think it goes to show how the effects of Bud Westmore really, obfuscated her legacy over the years and how devastating those effects can be down the line. And what better way to show that than to, take the readers on a journey and show how difficult it was to find things about her.
And to remind the people who are just joining us, Bud Westmore was her boss at Universal, who didn't like the fact that she got credit for designing the creature from the Black Lagoon and fired her when she came back from the publicity tour. So that obviously would be an obstacle to her career. We talked about some of the obstacles for you. And this even gets into trying to talk to other monster movie fans on the web. How were they kind of getting in the way when you were trying to get good information about Millicent?
The very first thing I did when I started researching this book was we reached out to a lot of film historians, monster movie nerds, filmmakers, and some of them were really supportive and helpful, but others were very, very upsetting about the entire thing. They gave me a lot of pushback. There were male film historians who told me that they didn't think Millicent did anything, that they thought that she was just somebody's girlfriend.
Really?
Yes.
Based on
really
what? Were they basing this on any hard information or just what they wanted to believe?
Just what they wanted to believe. And that's what the funny thing is there's so much hard proof that Millicent designed the creature and did so many other things that they just wanted to dismiss her because she was a woman.
So again, this is Millicent Patrick, who was born in 1915 as Mildred Elizabeth Fulvia Rossi. Her parents certainly had some talents and some travels. Tell us about them.
Yeah, she had quite a storied legacy. Her father was a man named Camille Rossi, and he was the superintendent of construction at Hearst Castle for 10 years when Millicent was a kid. So she grew up in this opulent Southern California estate. You know, this was a place where Winston Churchill and Charlie Chaplin liked to visit. It was very much this incredible home where celebrities were at all the time, and her father helped build it.
Wait, so let me underscore this. So Millicent spent 10 years of her life at San Simeon at the Hearst Castle?
Yeah, that's where she grew up.
Wow. We're talking to Mallory O'Meara here on the Jefferson Exchange about The Lady from the Black Lagoon, her book about Millicent Patrick. The book is subtitled Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 for questions and comments by phone, or send those by email to jx@jeffnet.org. I don't want to skip over a very important other woman in here, Julia Morgan, who was really... this would have been Mildred's dad's boss at San Simeon, right?
Yes. Julia Morgan was an incredible woman. She was a female architect working in California. She designed almost 800 buildings all over California. She was so, so talented, and she was the preferred architect of William Randolph Hearst. The problem was Camille Rossi did not like answering to a woman, so it created a lot of tension between the two over the years that they worked together, and that was ultimately why he was fired and stopped working there.
Oh, Camille, that is Mildred's father. I found myself hoping once I was learning about Julia that she had some influence on Millicent. Did she?
Unfortunately, she did not. What my belief is that Camille would bad talk Julia Morgan so much, and Millicent must have absorbed some of that. What was funny is that the person that had a lot of influence on Millicent Patrick was Millicent Hearst, and that was Hearst, William Randolph Hearst's wife. That's who she named herself after later in life. That's how she became Millicent Patrick.
So she was that close to did she know William Randolph Hearst himself?
She did. She always used to say that he scared her because he was such a big, tall man.
And of course, William Randolph Hearst, the inspiration for Citizen Kane, Charles Foster
yes.
Kane, very much like William Randolph Hearst. So a big, powerful man with a media empire in newspapers, which turned into a broadcasting empire later on. Do you have much in the way of letters or other descriptions of the time that Millicent Patrick spent with Millicent Hearst?
I do, actually. What was amazing is when I went to Hearst Castle multiple times to do research, and they unearthed a recording that they had of Millicent Patrick herself talking to a Hearst Castle librarian about her childhood there.
So you actually got to hear this in Millicent's voice?
Yes, it was really incredible.
Huh. Tell us more about that.
it was very surreal finally, because, you know, Millicent had an acting career as well. So up until that point, I had heard her speaking on screen so many times, but I had never gotten to hear her as a person, you know, in a private setting, speaking to another person, just having a conversation and getting to hear in her own words what it was like growing up at Hearst Castle, you know, growing up in San Simeon, hearing stories of her father and William Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies. It was very magical.
Marion Davies, this is the wife that William Randolph Hearst brought in after Millicent Hearst, right?
Yes, it was quite a scandal for the time.
And did Millicent Patrick talk about how well she got to know Marion Davies?
Just a little bit, but you can tell that the way that she talks, Millicent Hearst was really the person who influenced her. You know, she talked a lot about the time, the parties that Millicent Hearst had thrown there and how beautiful she was. And she really just made an impact on young Millicent.
How long was this recording that that you got to listen to at San Simeon of Millicent Patrick?
It's about 35 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just full, chock full of fantastic primary source information for me.
Oh, that is great. So with San Simeon as a focus, did the pieces of Millicent's life begin to fall into place a little easier after that?
Yes, especially because at that point, I figured out the name that she went under after she worked on Creature from the Black Lagoon, which was Millicent Trent. And once I started getting those names, and that recording helped me get it, that then I could go and look at different archives and different library collections, look under that name, and uncover more pieces of her life.
So you mentioned that ultimately Camille Rossi, Mildred's father, Mildred, who became Millicent's father, didn't get along well with Julia Morgan, who was the actual architect at San Simeon. And so San Simeon sounded like a place that was like an airport. It was always getting worked on. It was always getting built.
Yes. It was what's called an estate village. So it was really just a community and a village that was designed around to support Hearst Castle, because William Randolph Hearst wanted this big opulent home there, but there wasn't any, it was just in the middle of nowhere. There wasn't anything to support it. So Julia Morgan had to design roads and stables and warehouses and wharfs. And this was the tiny little village that, you know, where all the workers lived, and it was constantly being built and changed. And there was definitely an atmosphere of creativity and things being built and things happening all the time. It was not a sleepy place.
Well, and there was also the whims of William Randolph Hearst. I was doing a little research myself and looking up some images and found some of the telegrams that he used to send to Julia Morgan, indicating he had pieces of art that measured this by this and would she make space for that and stuff like that.
Oh, well, that was what's amazing is that, I mean, Camille Rossi had a lot of his own problems, but he was very brilliant. And William Randolph Hearst had a bad habit of walking onto a newly built site and saying, you know, can we make this a little bit bigger? And then they would have to tear it all out and build it all up again. And he just had these, you said it perfectly, he had these whims. You know, he would bring these antiques in and want them to be functional, even though they really didn't fit where he wanted them to go. So between Julia Morgan and Camille Rossi, they had to create all these structures to support these special pieces of antiques that he got from Europe.
So you mentioned that Camille got fired by Julia Morgan, or got fired by Hearst through Julia Morgan. So where did the Rossi family go then? I mean, they'd been at San Simeon for 10 years, was it?
Yes. So they moved down to Southern California. Julia Morgan actually helped Camille get a job with the Atomic Energy Commission. So they moved down to Glendale, California, and then Camille settled his family there. And Millicent started going to art school in Southern California, and that's what kicked off the next stage of her life.
Let's talk about some of the basic rules. We talked about what a pain that Camille was to work with for Julia Morgan, which ultimately got him fired. But he had other ways in which he was rather rigid. Talk about, for example, his rules on how Mildred, later Millicent, dressed.
Yes, they were a very, very strict family. And Millicent Patrick was a looker from, you know, when she first was a young girl. She's just so beautiful. And so he would force her to wear these draping black, thick, long dresses to sort of hide her figure.
Huh. And so she you mentioned she went to art school. Was she finished with high school by the time she left San Simeon and got to Glendale?
Yes, and she worked, she went to Glendale Community College for a couple of years, and that worked out fine for her, but she really wanted to be an artist, so she applied for 3 scholarships for an art school called the Chouinard Institute, which was run by a woman named Nelbert Chouinard, who was this very incredible woman, as this, you know, she was a year after women got the vote, she opened up her own art school in Southern California, and Millicent won every scholarship to go to Chouinard, and she started going to art school there and learning from Nelbert.
So I'm guessing that that Mildred by this point had some artwork to show from her work in school. I mean, do we know anything about people before she got to Chouinard who encouraged her or influenced her?
Yes, when she was at Glendale Community College, she was on the yearbook committee, and she did all the artwork for the yearbooks. And I actually got to go into their archives and see all the art she did in community college. She did these very beautiful illustrations for the yearbook, and you can really see her style that I mean, now I can recognize it from a mile away, but she was developing it even then.
So you could look at a bunch of artwork and go, that's a Millicent Patrick, and that's a Millicent Patrick.
Oh, absolutely. She had this very sort of soft, it almost looks like she was always drawing pastels, because she had this way of using ink and charcoal, but just very, very soft.
So does the image of her with the arm of the creature around her on the dust jacket of the book, is that an homage to her style?
Yes, and it's actually the same artist who did my tattoo of her.
Is that Matt Buck?
Yes.
Okay, we'll give him credit by name, and we'll talk more with Mallory O'Meara here on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, found in the capable hands of Mallory O'Meara. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Mallory and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about The Creature from the Black Lagoon, the 1954 movie featuring that amazing character that came to be known as Gillman. Mallory O'Meara, who was inspired by the movie and even further inspired by finding out that the person who had designed the costume for Gillman is a woman, decided to embark upon a project to investigate further, and it ended up in a book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. You can join our conversation with Mallory O'Meara herself, a horror movie producer, screenwriter, and now, of course, author. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the artwork of Millicent Patrick, who was still Mildred Rossi when she went to art school in the Los Angeles area, and the fact that you can identify her work pretty easily now. Is there a big trove of Millicent's artwork somewhere? Is there a major collection?
There is. I have a lot of it, which is fantastic. One of the things that really broke open the book for me was I found her family, and she left everything to her niece, and her niece gave me access to all the pieces of artwork. There was almost, between photos and artwork, there was almost 700 different pieces there.
Wow. So and a lot of those ended up in your collection?
Yes, they gave me some of them, and it was really great of them to do was I got to take pictures of everything. So I have them all on a hard drive, and if you get a hard copy of the book or an e-copy, there are photos in the book of never-before-seen pieces of art.
Wow, that's wonderful to get a chance to see her work. Was it sort of like finding something that had been buried into the pyramids for thousands of years?
Yes, I was the very first one to ever speak to her family. So at first, the first time I talked to them on the phone, they were a little bit baffled because no one had ever found them before. No one had ever talked to them before. But they were so, so gracious and invited me to their home. And it was like, finding all the gold at the end of the rainbow.
It truly is. So back in time to the story of Mildred, later Millicent herself, we talked about her enrolling at the Chouinard Institute in L.A., an art institute. And what do you know? A Mr. Disney visited. What did Walt want?
So what happened was the woman who ran the art institute, a woman named Nelbert Chouinard, had a relationship with Disney because he, at the time, couldn't afford to train his animators in the way that he needed them to be trained. And he was going all over to all the art schools in Southern California and asking them for help, and they all turned him down. But Nelbert said, you know what, I know you can't pay for this training right now, but just bring the guys down and we'll figure something out. So Disney would go every week, drive all of his animators himself down to the Chouinard Institute and get them trained there and then drive them all home. So Disney is spending a lot of time at the Chouinard Institute, and this sort of pipeline formed between the Institute and Disney because he got first pick of all the artists there. He got to see all the students and what they were working on and sort of pick out the ones that he wanted to hire. And that's when he saw Millicent Patrick.
And she apparently was kind of the cream of the crop at Chouinard.
Yes, she was very, very talented. So he asked her to come work for him at Disney in the ink and paint department.
Which does what?
So the ink and paint department was a really incredible place in the 1930s. So all of the animators at the time were men, but to get those animators' drawings onto the animation cells, which is what they would actually be filming, women went and painted and inked the drawings onto these tiny little quarter-sized cells, and it was a department that was 100% women.
Wow. So this is not only painstaking work, but fine work, it sounds like, as well. And, of course, this is onto bits of what? Celluloid, isn't it?
Yes. So it was very difficult work. It required a lot of skill and concentration. And Millicent was hired. She started in paint, but she had this incredible skill to convey a lot of movement and a lot of emotion in just a few lines. So she got bumped up to inking.
Okay, so she worked her way up the food chain at Disney. Fantasia, the early Disney classic. How profound an effect did that movie have on you, Mallory?
Oh, such an effect. It was the very first time I had ever seen art that made me feel something. The Night on Bald Mountain sequence, which really stands out in the film because it's the only horror segment. You know, I saw it when I was a little kid at my grandparents' house, and I fell in love with it. It was really the first time where I left watching a movie, and I remember thinking about it afterwards. And Chernabog, which is the demon in the segment, is my favorite animated monster. So when I found out Millicent worked on him as well, it just broke my brain open.
That really was a great circle, isn't it? And it's like, wow, I'm inspired by this movie. And Millicent Patrick worked on it.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. So that was the first movie where she was animating. While Fantasia was in development, she got bumped up from the ink and paint department to the special effects department. And that's when they were doing color animation. And that's what that segment needed. And she actually worked on quite a few segments in Fantasia. But that's the Night on Bald Mountain sequence is the one that really stuck out to me.
So, Mallory, how long did Mildred stay at Disney, and why leave?
So she only worked there for a couple of years. She ended up also animating on Dumbo, but this was an interesting time at Disney where it was during the strike to try to get Disney to be a union shop. But also Millicent left because she had terrible migraines. And looking at the light boxes that animators used and working under that bright light was very, very difficult for her physically. So she decided between that and the ongoing strike that it was time to leave.
Wow, I can just imagine. If light affects your migraine headache and you have to look directly at a bright light, that would kind of max you out. So her next career put her on camera. How did this come about?
So one of the other movies she worked on at Disney was a movie called The Reluctant Dragon, and it's an unusual Disney film in the way that it's live action but also animation. And there's a scene where Robert Benchley, who's the star of the film, and he's walking around the Disney lot, and he walks into a room full of animators, and they wanted to get real-life animators to be extras in that scene, and Millicent was one of them. And she got a taste for being on camera. She absolutely loved it. So after she left Disney, she started modeling. And she modeled for quite a few years, you know, at jewelry shows and at trade shows. And while she was done with a trade show one day, she was waiting on the corner for a bus to go home. And Howard Hawks's brother, a man named William Hawks, walked up to her, saw how beautiful she was, and thought that she should be in the pictures.
So he brought her to Howard Hawks' attention. Howard Hawks was the one who got her in movies?
Well, it was William Hawks was also trying to work on being a producer at the same time, mm-hmm. and he got her some background work on some of the major studio lots on Columbia, Universal, Paramount, and that's what really got her foot in the door into that scene.
So, obviously, at this point, we're talking about Millicent as an adult woman, and so the question would arise, what sort of relationship status did she have? And you write, she made garbage relationship decisions. Ouch.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Millicent Patrick. And then it was very important for me to write her as a human being in this book and to show all of her flaws as well, because I think that women are worthy of being written about, even if they make mistakes, even if they are flawed. And Millicent Patrick, almost all of her relations were very, all of almost all of her relationships were very, very tumultuous, including her first marriage, which ended in divorce, which was a very, very messy marriage. Her second relationship ended in a suicide. It was just she kept making these very, very poor relationship decisions.
So that answers a question from Anne in Grants Pass via email. Was Millicent married? Yes. Did she have any siblings or kids to use for the research of her life? And ultimately, the siblings were the ones that, or the kids of the siblings, helped you out.
Yes. So she didn't have any children over the course of her life, but she did have an older brother and a younger sister. And it was the daughter of the younger sister who was the one that ended up completely breaking open my case on this book.
How far, like, for example, after you heard Millicent's voice from the recording at San Simeon, did you finally find the niece?
It was about 6 months. It was quite a big gap because I hit a wall while I was looking for her. I found all the stuff about Hearst Castle, and I found everything on San Simeon, and that got me to the next stage. But after the Disney stuff, I really hit a wall, and I couldn't find anything about her. And I ended up going to the Mormon archives in Los Angeles, California, and I didn't realize until I went there that the Mormons have so much genealogical research, and it was going into their temple, going into their archives, and looking through all the names that Millicent had went under, that I realized, oh my gosh, she had a sister, and that sister had kids, and I just looked them up in the Yellow Pages.
Huh. All right. So,
and called them up.
So the phone book still has a use in the world today.
Oh, very old school, very old school technology, but it helped me out.
So did you have, like, I don't know, night sweats or anxiety or something about when you got to what looked like the end of the trail with Millicent before this?
Yeah, I was. There were a couple of times during the course of this project. I ended up researching her for almost 3 years, you know, right up until the end of the writing of the book. And there were a few times where I couldn't find the next step, and I was despairing, thinking, what if I can't write this book? What if I can't find her? So I started trying all different ways of finding out more information, including going to the Mormons.
Which worked. So
yes.
Let me come back to her career story, because you talked about William Hawks getting her to the movies. Generally, it sounds like as an extra, but so how did she get from there to the unusual move of getting behind the scenes as an artist?
So what Millicent Patrick did while she was on set, and anyone in the film industry knows that when you're either a background actor or a lead actor, any sort of actor that you are, there's a lot of downtime in between scenes and while you're waiting for them to set up lights and the cameras. So Millicent used that time very productively, and what she would do is she'd like to sketch, and she would sketch portraits of her co-stars. So while she was in the makeup chair for a movie, she showed those really, really talented sketches to a man named Bud Westmore, who was the head of the makeup department at Universal, and he saw how talented she was, and he hired her to be what we would now call a concept artist.
So Bud Westmore was the one who recognized her talent in the first place.
Yeah, so it's an interesting arc that he was the one who hired her in the first place, and he ultimately was what caused her downfall.
So how much detail could you find on how she got the task of creating Gilman? I know I was just looking at a picture in the book that some people criticize because the picture itself is clearly so stagey, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the information it contains is false.
Well, that was exactly it. There was quite a bit of information about her process of creating the creature, but because so many people dismissed her because she was a woman, no one looked at it. No one thought to look at it. And, you know, all of her process, Bud Westmore essentially took every quote that she ever gave about all the research that she did into ancient fossils and ancient reptiles and fish, and took it, like, he just, what we would say now, copy-pasted it, and said, and he claimed that research and work as his own. But if you just go back and see, Millicent was the one who said all of those things. So I there is quite a bit of detail on how she created the suit, and it just needed to get attributed to the correct person.
How did it eventually get attributed back to Millicent correctly?
Thanks to nerds on the internet. That was the great thing. The power of nerds is that actually the year that Millicent died was the year that Jeff Bezos bought IMDb and really powered it. So all of a sudden, these cinephiles that had been all over the world with these private collections and these, you know, scattered bits of information were able to put them all online, and people started figuring out, hey, this woman in this photo with the creature, I think she did something. So it had been sort of a rumor and a mystery for decades, but it wasn't until I wrote this book that I'm, you know, setting it in stone that Millicent designed Creature.
So give us a little sketch then about Millicent's life after Creature from the Black Lagoon, because she went on about another 40 years or so, didn't she?
Yes, and unfortunately, she never worked behind the scenes in Hollywood ever again. And I won't spoil too much for listeners who want to read the book, but she kept doing art. Bud Westmore, even though he tried, he really couldn't kill her artistic spirit. And she went on to live, I mean, again, if she had just designed the creature, this book would be interesting, but her life ended up being so storied and so fascinating, and she really ended up taking after her mother, and who was a society girl in San Francisco, and her life completely pivoted into some very interesting directions.
Yeah, well, you have to read the book to hear about the Baroness things.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff in there. So you had a couple of events now, I noticed, with a screening of Creature from the Black Lagoon and a talk back afterward. That must be fun for you.
Oh, yeah. I've been, in addition to all the bookstore events that I've been doing on this book tour, as I've been able to do a few screenings of Creature from the Black Lagoon. We did just one in New York, one in Austin, Santa Ana. We have one this Saturday in Los Angeles, in the downtown area. And it's very, very fun to have an audience be able to watch this movie with the knowledge that the monster was designed by a woman.
So, and is there a movie of yours due out about right about now?
Yes, I do have my movie is in theaters. There's it's screening in Portland right now, I believe. It's a film called Yamasong, and it's a live action puppet film, and it's sort of like The Dark Crystal meets Princess Mononoke.
Okay, that's a great buildup. All right, Mallory O'Meara is sharing her many talents with us here on the Jefferson Exchange. Film producer, screenwriter, and now author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters, and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Thanks for all the work in digging up Millicent's story and sharing it with us, Mallory.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. This was so much fun.
Oh, good. Glad you enjoyed it. Thanks for joining us.